Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One of every seven shares that traded hands on the New York Stock Exchange this Monday said Citigroup on them, almost $230 million in all. They traded at ever lower prices. Citigroup lost almost 5% today. A CEO resigning in disgrace will do that to you, not to mention another $11 billion in subprime losses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. And by creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards. On the web at creditcards.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Monday today, the 5th of November. Great to have you with us. Those guys on Wall Street like to do all kinds of complicated things, tricky structured finance investments that most of us just can't figure out. Former Citigroup CEO Charles Prince will have plenty of time to make sense of what went wrong. But here's one that the group now running the country's biggest bank will have to work on: what to do about actual banking. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet reports.
Both Moody's and Fitch downgraded Citigroup debt today. That was after Citi said it might have to swallow another $11 billion in mortgage bond losses. Joe Scott is a senior director at Fitch Ratings. He says Citi's retail customers shouldn't worry.
I don't think anything's really changed from a retail perspective. This primarily revolves around capital markets charges. And because we think they're manageable, I don't see any direct effect on the retail operations.
Some investors say Citigroup moved into too many other businesses, like investment banking and insurance. New management might decide to split the financial giant up. Citi was planning to expand its retail division. It's the biggest bank in the country, but it has only 1,000 U.S. branches. Bank of America is five times the size. David Wagstaff of PA Consulting Group works with the banking sector. He says domestic expansion is probably off the table.
But there are a number of things that are happening in the marketplace which may have them rethink their strategy of national growth. Opening branches is becoming relatively more expensive as it's tougher to gain consumers.
Retail banking in the U.S. is a slow growth area, but Scott of Fitch Ratings doesn't expect Citi to ditch its domestic retail business anytime soon. He says most of the bank's future expansion will happen abroad, in emerging markets, or in countries where people save more. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
Time Warner's Richard Parsons joined Citigroup's Chuck Prince among the unemployed today, in a manner of speaking. Time Warner announced Parsons will be stepping down as CEO effective January 1st. He will stay on as chairman of the board, though. Jeffrey Bukas, Time Warner's COO at the moment, gets the top job. Now, indulge me, if you would, in a little pop quiz. What is the most valuable company in the world by market capitalization? Walmart? New, only in the retail business there. General Electric, maybe. It is right up there, but not right on top. What's that? ExxonMobil, you say? Well, yes, until today, when a big stock sale in China turned into a gusher of an initial public offering. It made PetroChina the first company in the history of the planet to be worth more than $1 trillion. But hang on just a sec, because some analysts are warning the market valuation of the Chinese oil giant is artificially high. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
Since this is the radio, you're going to have to imagine this really long number, a dollar sign with a one followed by a dozen zeros. Now, you also need to envision the asterisk right next to it, leading to a very important qualification. It's true the value of all the PetroChina stock in circulation amounts to $1 trillion, but a lot of analysts are worried that it really adds up to more air in a stock market bubble that keeps on growing in Shanghai. Blame a lack of investment options for the Chinese people. China watcher Donald Strassheim of Roth Capital Partners says the country's stock market has a captive audience.
the rate of return on their bank savings is very low, and the only equity market they can participate in legally is the one in China.
That helps explain why PetroChina is now worth more than twice as much as ExxonMobil, even though Asia's top oil and gas producer has been roughly half as profitable as the American oil giant. In fact, independent energy researcher Kurt Wolf of McDepp Associates thinks things would be very different if Beijing lifted its restrictions.
If the Chinese government allowed Chinese investors to buy stocks outside of China, they'd rush into Exxon and sell their PetroChina because of the wide valuation difference. There's no question about it. I wouldn't buy the stock, obviously, at the Shanghai market price.
A lot of investors apparently agree PetroChina's shares on the New York Stock Exchange actually fell in value today by nearly 13%. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's another economic indicator found in out-of-the-way places, the price of helium. Next time you rent a tank of it to fill up balloons for a party or something, get ready to pay double what you would have 5 years ago. Helium is the second most abundant element in the universe. But here on planet Earth, the gas is getting harder to come by. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
At Balloon Bouquets on Manhattan's west side, John Kakalechik inflates a latex balloon with an increasingly precious gas. Helium supplies are so tight, he stopped renting tanks to his customers for parties. He's raised his balloon prices almost 20%.
Helium prices went up five times this summer, twice actually in 1 week.
The shortage began about this time last year as global supplies failed to keep up with demand. Despite what your child might think, helium is good for more than making your voice sound like this. It cools the magnets used in MRIs. It's used to make computer chips and flat-screen TVs. Hans Stewart is a spokesman with the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. He says more than a third of the world's supply comes from a single U.S. government stockpile near Amarillo, Texas.
At most, this reserve at current rates of withdrawal is about 10 and a half or 11 years left of helium.
New sources in Qatar and Algeria have been slow to get off the ground. Helium broker Andrea Pichardo says high prices have driven some of her customers out of the balloon business altogether.
We are on the edge of our seats waiting because it gets to the point where how much would somebody purchase a balloon for?
But the balloon business has sailed through tough times before. During a helium shortage in the 1950s, Macy's filled its famous Thanksgiving Day parade balloons with air and lifted them by crane. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today was one of those days when you knew even before the bell which way stocks were going to go, and they did. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Google made a big announcement today, and even though it drove shares up almost 2%, the news might have struck some as underwhelming. To the dismay of gadget geeks everywhere, there will be no Google phone. But what the company does have planned could turn out to be an even bigger deal. Kevin Delaney covers Google for the Wall Street Journal. Kevin, good to have you with us.
Great, thank you.
So what we have here is not the G phone, the Google phone, but something else really entirely. What is it?
Well, Google is releasing with a bunch of partners, handset makers, carriers, there are about 34 of them in all, this thing it calls Android. And Android is a software platform for cell phones. And basically what it does, it's software that runs inside your cell phone. It's Linux-based. It's all the sort of software that controls what your cell phone does. And Google and these others are making this software available free and open source for basically anybody who makes a cell phone to use. And they say it's going to bring some advanced features to cell phones when the phones that run it start hitting the market for consumers in the second half of next year.
I'm going to go way out on a limb here and guess that this all has something to do with Google advertising on your cell phone and making that work.
Yeah, right? You got it. You're all over it.
You know, in theory now, Google has a customer base, I guess an audience base that is the whole internet, right? Is it? And what it's trying to do is expand that to everybody on the planet with a cell phone.
Correct. There are about 3 billion cell phones out there or something like that, and far fewer PCs in the world. And Google's taking this sort of broad view that, you know, for years the telephone carriers and the handset makers have not made it particularly easy for Google to get their services in any visible way on their handsets. And Google's basically decided to try and sort of blow up their model and blow up the walls a little bit and get themselves in there by providing easy access to the web where Google has all these ads and some other applications that Google will benefit from.
I think I heard you say at the beginning that they're going to give it away. How are they going to make money if they're giving it away? Just by those ad revenues?
Yeah, exactly. It's by the ad revenues that Google's going to do this.
What's the incentive for these handset makers, these phone companies, to participate with Google and to put its software on their pieces of equipment?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The handset makers and the carriers have really struggled with Google's presence busting in on their industry. The carriers struggle with it more. But what we're seeing is that Google's giving away software. It's actually a pretty attractive thing. Google says that software represents about 10% of the cost of a handset. Plus, carriers see a potential revenue stream in this ad revenue that Google said it's likely going to share. And I think that's part of the answer, that there are benefits to the carriers, although a lot of them are still pretty concerned about whether Google might eat their lunch in the end.
Let me ask you very quickly about the consumer experience. When I fire up my new WhizBang, not a G phone, but with Google software on it phone next fall or whenever this comes out, am I going to see the big Google logo someplace? Am I going to know?
Well, you know, they're releasing this as open source, and so people can, the handset makers and the carriers can use it any way they want, and that includes including or taking off the Google logo. Google's negotiating with the carriers, especially, to have Google prominently on any devices that use the software. You got to believe they've got an in to do this so that your default search engine might be Google, your homepage might be Google when you boot up this browser. And Google executives have not ruled out that there won't be a G phone at some point. They're very coy in speaking with journalists today, and they said, you know, if there's going to be a G phone Android, this software that they're releasing would be the platform upon which it would be built. So there's still a chance that we might see Google devices coming into the market at some point in the future.
Kevin DeLane is a senior writer for the Wall Street Journal. He covers Google out of their San Francisco offices. Kevin, thanks a lot for your time.
Great, thank you.
This is the richest retail market in the world. If companies can't make a buck here, well, maybe they're not really doing it right. Like, say, foreign retail chains. For many of them, especially the Brits, the U.S. has become a bottomless money pit. But the British grocery giant Tesco is trying to succeed where so many others have failed. This week, it opens five stores across Southern California, and we asked Stephen Beard whether the company known as England's Walmart can break Britain's retail losing streak.
Tesco has been called the supermarket chain that is eating Britain. It's gobbled up a 31% share of the food market here. Andrew Sims, author of Tescopoly, says the name that Tesco's chosen for its American launch, Fresh and Easy, is ironic.
As a company, they are anything but fresh and easy. They're very big, they're very aggressive, they're expanding. The way that they handle their business relationships with their suppliers and with local authorities are tough, to say the least.
Tesco is popular with consumers, but the company is facing a backlash over its expansion plans in Britain.
Our lives will be made a complete and utter absolute misery by the noise and the destruction which is
moving into the US. Tesco is adopting a low-key approach, says international marketing consultant Alison Stewart Allen.
They are positioning themselves as your neighborhood market, and they're playing up the attributes of being in local neighborhoods. They're having small store formats.
Fresh and Easy neighborhood market stores will be about a quarter the size of the average supermarket. They will sell both fresh food and ready-made meals. Retail analyst Robert Clark believes this should work well in the U.S.
You have your big superstores, your major grocery stores, and you have your smaller local stores, but there's actually not a lot in between.
He reckons that Tesco can fill that gap, offering Walmart-style low prices through its massive purchasing power. It's also painting itself green, using solar power in its distribution centre, and it will be playing up its social responsibility the way it has in Britain.
Petition your parents. Bribe your brother.
This ad is part of one of Tesco's many cause-related marketing campaigns.
Nag your nan to make sure they pick up their computers for schools vouchers when they're at Tesco.
Through this promotion, Tesco has given British schools computers worth a total of more than $200 million. Alison Stewart-Allen.
Certainly American parents would immediately see the value in that sort of promotion in terms of coupon collecting, which is much more of an American pastime anyway than it is in the UK.
Tesco plans to open more than 100 Fresh and Easy stores over the next year in the western US and then spend $500 million annually on further expansion. The company has said it would like to be as big in the US as it is in Britain. That ambition has certainly caught Walmart's attention, says Robert Clark.
They've recruited, in fact, one or two former Tesco employees and put them on the West Coast to have a look at what's going on. So I think they probably are a little bit worried, and they certainly will be watching it very closely.
If two of the world's most ferociously competitive retail giants clash, that could mean lower prices for American shoppers. But, claims Tesco critic Andrew Sims, local communities could suffer, just as they have in Britain.
The problem is that when you get two great elephants like this fighting, it's the grass beneath their feet that gets trampled, and the grass beneath their feet is the small and independent retailers that create the character, distinctiveness and value in local economic life.
The US has proved a graveyard for British retailers, but few analysts here expect Tesco to be crushed. One way or another, Britain's biggest and most successful supermarket chain seems certain to leave its mark on America. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, taking the rosy view on some pricey rocks.
I still love the idea that diamonds are bought for love, for engagement, for gifts, for special anniversaries. I would still like to have some belief that that still exists in this world.
But first, let's do the numbers. Big questions about the health of banking tarnished the markets today. The Dow Industrials gave up more than one-third of 1%, 51 points, to end at 13,543. The NASDAQ lost 0.5%, 15 points, to finish at 2795. The S&P 500 shaved off 0.5%, 7 points there, to wind up at 1502. Investors sold shares in a whole slew of banks today. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley each took around 5% off the table. Barclays sank nearly 3.5%. Merrill Lynch, Credit Suisse, and Bear Stearns kissed at least 2% goodbye. Bank of America fell 1.5%. Home Depot edged down nearly 2%. Lowe's lost 3.33%. Deutsche Bank downgraded the retailer's shares and lowered its profit estimates on the continued housing slump. On the bright side, Interactive Corp zoomed up 7.5%. Today, IAC is the owner of Ticketmaster and the HSN Home Shopping Network. It's splitting into 5 separate companies. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health and reduce costs for business. AAFP.org/value. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
Here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The Foreign Affairs Committee holds a hearing on Yahoo's alleged cover-up of a human rights case in China. Astronomers will announce findings about a new planetary system similar to our own. And on this day in 1984, the New York Stock Exchange broke from almost 200 years of tradition and remained open during presidential elections. Traders shouted boo, but the Dow Jones said yay and gained 15 points. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Pakistanis aren't going to let a state of emergency get in the way of good corporate public relations. The Federation of Pakistan Chambers of Commerce and Industry announced this weekend it'll honor 100 companies in Pakistan with its first ever Brands of the Year Awards. The Federation says the awards will pay specific attention to how well a Pakistani company's brand plays abroad. When it comes to the image of American brands overseas, though, commentator Benjamin Barber says there's a lot of work yet to be done.
Brand America isn't in very good shape. If you trot the globe like I do, be prepared to pretend you're from Canada or Australia so they won't label you Made in America. The sorry state of Brand America is a lesson in modern marketing and the meaning of brands. A brand is more than a trademark. It's a tribute to a company's reputation. This is why economists estimate that brand reputation may represent up to one half of the real value of a business. Companies like Google and eBay have stock values much higher than their assets and income warrant because of the perceived value of the brand. Now, when it comes to Brand USA, the assets remain in place. World-beating economy, peerless military machine, global media culture, and endless hard power potential. But the reputation has vanished down a black hole. Think Iraq, think global warming, think dollar doldrums. Like Tylenol, after it released a bad shipment, Brand America has gone toxic. Don't blame public diplomacy. When brands lose their panache, it's not lousy advertising, but lousy business practices that are to blame. Perhaps the best proof comes from those classically American brands like McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Nike, and nowadays General Motors. These companies do their biggest business outside North America and have built their global name on the strength of Brand USA. But now they're running away from Brand USA to preserve their image abroad. Take McDonald's. Once perhaps the preeminent American franchise, they are now trying to disguise themselves as something other than American. So in France, they bought the rights to Asterix. These days, it's this famous Gaelic comic book icon and not Ronald McDonald who's selling Big Macs in Paris. Restoring Brand America means fixing what's wrong with America. Not jiggling with the ads, but fixing the product, American foreign policy. We will know we've succeeded when McDonald's gives its French megaphone back to Ronald McDonald.
Benjamin Barber is a distinguished senior fellow at Demos. That's a New York-based think tank. How is our brand doing? You can tell us online at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. If you really want to get a handle on the economic conventional wisdom, forget about that guy Bernanke and the Federal Reserve. Take a stroll on over to the precious metals trading pits. Gold, a traditional safe haven in times of trouble, bumped up against $809 an ounce today. The shiny yellow stuff is up 28% so far this year. Precious gems are a popular investment when the economy's shaky, too. But you can't just trade diamonds the same way you trade gold or platinum. At least, not yet, anyway. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
For somebody who makes his living from the precious stones, Martin Rappaport doesn't have much patience with all this business about diamonds being forever or a girl's best friend.
What they are trying to do is to embellish the romantic concept of diamonds, which is fine. And they're selling a make-me-feel-good-today product.
Rappaport speaks with intensity, like he expects to be cut off before he's done talking, which is a real possibility given the heresy of his idea. Rappaport wants to start a diamond futures exchange. That is, a way for investors to trade diamonds like a commodity, buying bags of gems the same way they do bars of gold or sacks of wheat. He tried it once before in the 80s, but a collapsing diamond market doomed the project. Now he's trying again. So are a couple of others. But the traditional diamond business is skeptical.
For real?
If you've ever bought a diamond in the United States, whether at Tiffany or at Walmart, it probably passed through this sparkly block of 47th Street at some point.
What are they? They're 0.9?
0.91 center.
New York's Diamond District is an odd, very old New York kind of neighborhood. Hasidic men stand around talking in Yiddish. Creepy-looking guys hustle passersby to sell their gold and diamonds. And the runners, rumor has it, walk down the block with small fortunes of stones rattling around in their pockets like loose change.
The business still runs on some pretty old-fashioned values. Saul Goldberg works in his family's diamond company. He acknowledges that diamonds are starting to be seen as a kind of hard asset, but he likes to take a more romantic view of the business.
I'm a little bit old school. I've been in the business around 30 years, and I still love the idea that diamonds are bought for love, for engagement, for gifts, for special anniversaries. I would still like to have some belief that that still exists in this world.
That sort of sentiment gets Martin Rappaport all riled up.
To knock the idea and try to blind the world to the fact that diamonds are really a commodity, I mean, I think that's just absolutely wrong.
But commodities can be romantic, can't they? I mean, look at gold or platinum. I asked Ronald Friedman. He runs his family diamond business, and he's the president of the Diamond Manufacturers and Importers Association.
I knew you were going to use the C word. Commodities. You talk about gold, platinum, other metals, oil. Those are all things that are always the same. No two diamonds are ever the same. Even if they weigh the same, they have the same measurements, they're cut to the same angles. There is always something different from one diamond to another.
Nonsense, says Martin Rappaport.
We can put diamonds on the table here and bring in experts, and they're not going to be able to tell the difference between the two diamonds.
Some dealers argue Rappaport's plan would make it too easy to manipulate prices. And there's the unspoken worry that knowing a diamond's exact value could make it hard for dealers to make money. Rappaport says a futures exchange could actually end up saving dealers money. Still, even if he can convince the skeptical to get involved, it could take years to create an exchange. For now, Rappaport's running monthly online auctions, trying to get a baseline price on which to fix his futures. But even his critics concede that if anybody can pull this off, Rappaport can. Back in the 70s, Rappaport was kicked out of the Diamond Dealers Club for creating a price sheet for the gems. In those days, two dealers simply sat down and negotiated a price. These days, nobody would consider buying or selling a diamond without a copy of Rappaport's price sheet. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, at last, a practical application of the intricacies of the foreign exchange markets. The Brazilian supermodel Gisele Bündchen has joined those who say they've lost confidence in the U.S. currency. Bündchen is demanding that her contracts be paid out in euros instead of dollars. And there's a new Jay-Z video featuring the hip-hop star cruising New York and flipping through a stack of 500 euro notes. The song is going to be featured in the new film American Gangster. Today, just, you know, in case you're curious, the dollar was trading at almost $1.45 to the euro. A year ago, it was closer to $1.27. And that is Marketplace on this Monday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave up 51 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq dipped 15 points, half a percent. The S&P 500 slumped 7 points. That's a half a percent there as well. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Our senior producer is Celeste Wesson. Next time on the program, military families fight their battles close to home.
One of the first houses we ever moved in had linoleum tile all the way through it. You'd stand out from the on the front street, and you could see that the roof line sagged. It was infested with termites.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.